We continue our study in Paul's letter to Timothy. That's the first letter to Timothy. We're in chapter 6. We're going to look at verses 5 to 11 this morning. And we looked at a bit of verse 5 last week, and it's sort of a transitional verse, so we'll pick it up again at verse 5. If you are visiting with us this morning, or you haven't been here for a while, let me get you just a little bit caught up on what we're about to look at. When the Apostle Paul writes this letter to Timothy, Timothy has been assigned to pastor the church in Ephesus. So this is a letter that's not only going to be read by Timothy, but is obviously going to be read by the people in the church at Ephesus. And the Holy Spirit has inspired Paul to write the various subjects and the various topics that are addressed here. And one of the things that God is obviously rather concerned about with the church at Ephesus, and here we mention them again, we just mentioned them about first love, but now we're talking about the church of Ephesus here again. Obviously, the Lord is rather concerned that false teachers have infiltrated this church. And these false teachers, in their false teaching, have been influencing the church. And the false doctrine that's being taught by these false teachers is sadly starting to find practice in the church. And one of the problems with false teaching is that it's kind of like putting a little bit of yeast into dough. You think that maybe that yeast will only affect one small corner of the bunch of dough, but anybody who's ever done any baking and has even thrown a little bit of yeast into a batch of dough finds out what? The yeast spreads into the whole thing. It has almost a contagious spread about it. It's kind of the same way when you consider false doctrine being taught by false teachers. You can't just control it in one little area. It's kind of like, how many of you have ever battled blackberries on your property? I always laugh because when I used to come out to BC before I moved here, I thought blackberries were just the most wonderful thing. You know, they grew on all the sides of the roads. They had fruit and come from Manitoba. That was a real treat. And of course, you know, the guys with the Manitoba plates are stopped beside every blackberry bush and they're filling their faces with these things. They're thinking, boy, if I ever move to BC, I'm going to get me some of them blackberry bushes. Well, I moved to BC and I got me some of them blackberry bushes, but I didn't plant them. Because those crazy things go from one yard to the next, to the next, to the next. They are a cursed weed with lots of thorns. You know, I look at BC people and I go, you don't even eat those anymore, do you? And there's no. Somebody told me one time the only way to pick blackberries is to take a 4x8 sheet of plywood, throw it into the patch, walk around the plywood, pick it up, throw it again. And you can't even damage those silly blackberries by throwing down a sheet of 4x8 plywood. Anyway, the idea is how it spreads. Well, it's kind of the same with false teaching being taught by false teachers. The problem is that it just spreads all over. So when we look at this letter that Paul writes to Timothy, it's only got six little chapters in it, and three times in six little chapters, this subject of false teachers and false teaching is brought up. We saw it back in chapter 1, we looked at it in chapter 4, and now we're looking at it again in chapter 6. And just to give you some of the immediate context of what we're about to start in this week in verse 5, I need to just quickly go through what we looked at last week in verses 3 to 5. In 3 to 5, Paul told us this, or maybe the Lord spoke through Paul and through the pen that Paul was using to write this, that this is what the church was taught. It is, number one, that false teachers really don't care when they contradict God's revealed truth in his scriptures. How can you tell a false teacher? Well, you say, wait a second. I hear what you're saying and I hear what you're trying to teach, but how does that line up with the scriptures? And if you go to this false teacher and say, hey, that doesn't line up with the scriptures, the false teacher doesn't care. Why? Because he's not submitted to the scriptures to begin with. Therefore, he's quite comfortable in teaching something that goes way beyond the scripture. So there's problem number one. You can tell a false teacher because they don't really care if they contradict what God has already revealed in his word. Secondly, you can tell a false teacher because they're really not interested in promoting church unity that's based on God's truth. Now, as a pastor, I am concerned about church unity, but I cannot compromise our way to unity here. In fact, every time you compromise, you probably create a little more disunity. the unity that the church is supposed to have is a unity that comes when everybody in the church submits themselves to God's truth. When we clearly understand what God's truth says, and then we say, yes, Lord, if that's what you have revealed, that's what we shall do. That brings true unity. False teachers aren't interested in that. They are much more comfortable with spreading dissension and dividing people. Why? Because it gives them a better platform to work from. They're actually more comfortable with having a church in turmoil than having a church in unity. The third thing that Paul told us last week in our passage was that false teachers will most certainly manipulate a form of godliness. Now, the scripture uses this expression a couple of times, a form of godliness. One of the other usages is a form of godliness without the power of godliness. Have you ever experienced somebody who is advocating or teaching what you would consider simply a form of godliness? Used religious words, talked about the person of God, even was somewhat appealing to your ears, but when you lined it up with what the scripture said, hey, it did not line up because it was not actually godliness. It was an unreasonable, not a reasonable, but an unreasonable facsimile of godliness. It was just a form. It was masquerading as godliness. And these false teachers will manipulate a masquerade of godliness for what? For personal advantage. You will find that most of the con men in this world have realized one thing. That you can manipulate religious people. And you can spin a tale or you can get them going in a certain direction where a false teacher can actually make a good buck off of this. Now, if I was going to confess something to you this morning, I think I have figured out how I could make a fast buck and make my remaining years in ministry fantastically financially profitable. None of you would probably want to ever listen to me again. Some of you might. That'd be a problem. But I know which buttons to push, I think. Greed buttons, selfishness buttons. And I could start preaching in such a way that would appeal to an actual sinful nature instead of appealing to godliness. And I could get people to give me lots of money to do it. You ever stop to think how scary that thought is? The false teachers manipulate a false form of godliness in order to gain a particular advantage. And in particular, we're probably talking money here. Have you ever heard of people that are supposedly involved in ministry who are really pursuing personal gain? Folks, watch out. As we pick up our text this morning, I want you to consider what Paul said back in verse 5. Because I said it was a transitional verse. In verse 5, Paul is talking about these false teachers, and he says they promote a constant friction between men of depraved mind and those who are deprived of the truth. And then he goes on to say, who suppose that godliness, and here I'd put godliness in quotation marks, this isn't real godliness, this is fake godliness, who suppose that godliness is a means of gain. In other words, you can make a fast buck out of promoting false godliness. Now, what Paul does in our passage this morning is he takes two of those words, the word godliness and the word gain, and he actually picks up on them, and he does a contrast with them, and then he develops what we should be looking for as the people of God. What is godliness? And it's not the godliness that's being promoted by the false teachers. And what is gain? And it's certainly not the gain that's being promoted by the false teachers. But indeed, Paul will tell us this morning that there is such a thing as true gain, useful profit. And this comes from real godliness. One of the problems that we have is that false teachers are pretty slick at figuring out how to appeal to the sinful nature, even of those who are in the church. Now, I'm going to ask a question here this morning, and I don't know how many of us will be able to answer this honestly. I'm not looking for a show of hands. But how many of us does the idea of getting rich, to how many of us does that appeal? Getting rich basically appeals to us, does it not? But do you see a basic fundamental problem with the idea of getting rich and being a servant of Jesus Christ? And hopefully you're going to see that as we get into this text a little bit more. So these false teachers are able to promote a form of godliness that they promise will result in worldly wealth, and worldly wealth right now. What's the problem here? This is an appeal to selfishness. What is the essence of Christian discipleship? Deny self. This is fundamentally opposed. All right? Those who promote such ideas need to be recognized for who they are and what they're talking about. I think Paul did a nice little description back in verse 5, by the way. He talked about men of depraved mind and deprived of the truth. Next time you hear one of these fake wealth preachers preaching, you should say, "Hey, you, depraved mind, and you're deprived of truth." Problem is, you'll probably offend some other greedy Christian who's hoping for that 100 back on the one. Because every time you challenge this, boy, do you get some heat back from certain circles. Because they're really hoping that that wealth preaching is going to come true. Oh, yeah, yeah, people of God. We cannot be caught up in this false teaching. We are to pursue a form of godliness that does not result in worldly wealth. Now, that might be a little bit disturbing for some of us this morning. Are we to be poor? Well, we'll talk about that as we get along in here. Our text this morning says that pursuing a form of godliness that results in worldly wealth is not the will of God. All right, let's do an outline for what we're about to look at here. We're going to talk about true gain that comes from godliness, from true godliness. So 4 points. Number one, and you should have this in that little outline sheet. True gain that comes from true godliness does not factor in a material wealth component as essential. I'm going to break some hearts this morning, but I'm going to tell you that the gospel does not guarantee that you get rich in this world, financially rich. If somebody told you that, they lied to you. Let's be that straight up about this. Secondly, true gain that comes from godliness usually creates in us a need to scale down or to scale back what we require to live in this world. If you know true gain that comes from true godliness, you're not trying to get more and more and more and more. The leech has two daughters, and one says more, and the other one says more. We need to seriously ask ourselves the question, what is enough when it comes to the things of this world? Third point, true gain that comes from true godliness avoids the danger of desiring after riches. And this is where, you know, this gets really intense and personal, because I don't know that there's anybody in this room who really doesn't want to be rich. If we're going to be honest, anybody here really desire to be a poverty case? probably not that many of those, but more of the former. And the fourth point this morning is that true gain that comes from true godliness establishes a safe distance from materialism, and it does so by focusing on true godliness and not the things of this world. Let me read for you the passage we're about to look at this morning. So I'm in 1 Timothy chapter 6, beginning at verse 5. And we're talking about the constant friction that comes between men of depraved mind and those deprived of the truth, who suppose that godliness is a means of gain, and that would be financial gain. But godliness actually is a means of great gain when it is accompanied by contentment. For we have brought nothing into the world, so we cannot take anything out of it either. If we have food and covering, with these we shall be content. But those who want to get rich fall into temptation and a snare, and many foolish and harmful desires, which plunge men into ruin and destruction. For the love of money is a root of all sorts of evil. And some, by longing for it, have wandered away from the faith and pierced themselves with many griefs. But flee from these things, you man of God, and pursue righteousness, godliness, faith, love, perseverance, and gentleness. Now, I'm going to try something a little bit different in the way I handle this text. Usually I go through a verse and then I give you the point. I'm going to give you the point first. That way, hopefully, you can see what I'm talking about as I go through the verse. So the first point we want to look at this morning will be in the second part of verse 5. And here's the point. That true gain from godliness does not factor in material wealth as an essential component. In other words, the gospel does not guarantee that you will be materially rich in this life. What are we looking at here? Well, clearly the false teachers that were troubling the church in Ephesus expected to be able to cash in. That's an expression. To get money for themselves based on the form of godliness that they taught. Now, we're not exactly sure what that form of godliness is. In the day and age in which we live, one of the most common ways that false ministers try to cash in on a form of godliness is to promise you what we would call the hundredfold heresy. Do you remember Jesus makes the comment in the Gospels where he says, you know, the Lord shall return at 30, 60, 100-fold. And they take that screaming and kicking out of context. And what do they say that means? They say that every dollar that is given to their ministry, almost always their ministry, that the Lord has promised you that you shall get it back 30, 60, and 100-fold. And so you got people at home with their calculators saying, okay, let's see, I got this much debt, I owe this much on my house, da-da-da-da-da, I need to invest exactly da-da-da-da-da in this ministry, and I get it back at 100-fold, bingo, I'm free. And I've heard guys deliberately and shamelessly say exactly this, teachers. Gain, in this case, has a financial understanding. And if you don't think it does, then go to verse 10. What does it say? For the love of money. Okay, so let's connect up. What are we talking about when we talk about gain? We're talking finances here. And the term godliness here, that those who suppose that godliness back in verse 5, are we talking actually about godliness? No, we're talking about a false, manipulated, religious-sounding teaching that serves the purposes of the teacher to make him or her rich. Now, let's not leave out the ladies here. There's lots of false women teachers as well. We'll be inclusive. But the thing here is that the godliness being referred to in verse 5 is not a godliness that reflects the will of God. Because godliness would always reflect the person and the will and the intentions of the holy God. That's not what's happening here. So Paul has described these false teachers in verses 3 to 5 basically as unscrupulous scoundrels. Those who would steal in the name of God to make themselves rich. Now folks, this has been going on for generation to generation. In Jesus' day, how much stealing went on in the name of God to make the chief priests and the guys who ran the temple rich? Do you realize that when the Romans finally overran Jerusalem in 70 AD, they got their hands on the temple treasury? They couldn't believe what they found in the temple treasury, how much money was there. In fact, they had enough money to build the Colosseum in Rome out of the temple treasury in Jerusalem. And all of this money, for practical purposes, had all been stolen in the name of God. By the way, do you think God looks upon that benignly? Let's use that word. Favorably? I'd suggest not. This is a teaching of a wealth gospel. That's what these guys are promoting. Is this appealing? Well, has anybody ever said to you, you know what, I'm a king's kid? There's a phrase I love. What does it mean when you say, I'm a king's kid? That means I should live like a king, right here, right now. I should be spared no luxury. I should indulge myself in everything I possibly want. If the pastor has a Rolls Royce and his wife has one, I should have two. Why? Because we're hitting the greed button. And everything's becoming selfishness at this point in time. Why is this so appealing? Because human beings are so disgustingly me-centered. And if you feel offended by that, well, I'm offended by that too, because I'm so disgustingly me-centered. And the Lord is working on me day by day. And that's why denying self is a daily process. You get up in the morning and here I am again, Lord. I must deny self. I must humble self. Why? Because I am disgustingly me-centered. And if you don't think you are, well, then the Lord shall reveal that to you too. Anyway, the denying of self is the essence of discipleship. But Paul looks at that idea from verse 5. Those who are advocating a false godliness and advocating a way to get rich in this world on the basis of a false godliness. And now what Paul does is he goes into verse 6 here and he uses the same two words again, godliness and gain. But boy, does he establish a contrast. If this is what godliness and gain meant to the false teachers, how should we who seek the truth of God understand the ideas of godliness and gain? Well, what does it say? But godliness, now actually is applied in my English version here, is a means of great gain when accompanied by contentment. I find that to be a little bit unclear in English. Let me see if I can give this to you in a little bit clearer form and rephrase this. I think a better way to rephrase and to understand verse 6 is this: to be content with just godliness is great gain. To be content with just godliness is great gain. What have we left out? All the material wealth. Is it actually great gain? Now, we talked about simply gain in verse 5, but Paul talks about mega gain in verse 6. Big gain, huge gain. It is incredible gain to have just godliness with contentment. All right. How many of you are thinking, well, wait a second, I'm a little bit more comfortable, Pastor, with a mixture of godliness and materialism? Why? Because I live in a material world, and I do need some material stuff, because I've got a flesh and blood body. Fair enough. We'll talk about that in the verses to come. But the way that it's expressed in verse 6 is the idea that if you had godliness and there was no materialism attached to it at all, it would still be mega gain. Why? What are the benefits of godliness that are not material? How about salvation? Let's throw one there. How about protection? How about the provision of God? Oh, wait a second, that's material. Yeah, well, how about the adoption into the family of God? How about being freed as a slave from sin? How about real truth and a life that actually has real value and purpose in serving the Lord as opposed to just chasing after the things of this world? How about the promise that Jesus will never leave you nor forsake you? You see where I'm going with this? Are there benefits that don't necessarily have a dollar value attached to them? Oh, absolutely. I want to look at that word contentment. That is an interesting word. It only is found two times in the New Testament, and Paul uses it both times. That is a word that was being bounced around in the culture that Paul was writing to. There was a group of individuals that had a following, and this group of individuals was called the Stoics. You ever heard that word before? If somebody is very stoic, what are they? Means they're basically detached from their emotions. Because the Stoics prided themselves, we don't react either too passionately or too dispassionately. We don't get too happy. We don't get too sad. We're just kind of, you know, calm and level at all things. The Stoics were big into projecting that they weren't materialists. Why do I laugh? Because you can project that you're not a materialist, but to some extent, every one of us is a materialist. Why? Because we do like to eat. We do like to be covered. We do like to have shelter. And when the shopping channel comes on, we buy silly things. No. Anyway. The Stoics said that they're separated from the world, that they don't react, they're emotionalists. And the Stoics said that we're not materialistic. And the Stoics said, and we value contentment. Now, when they use that word contentment, this is what the word means. Self-sufficiency. Do you usually think self-sufficiency when you think contentment? No. But let me put it this way. If you are a relatively rich person, and of course we can debate what rich means, but if you've got a good, healthy bank account and lots of friends who will look after you and a social safety system in your government and all kinds of stuff, and you got all this stuff behind you, can you then project the image of saying, but I'm not materialistic? Well, you can project it, but what's the reality? You're just pretending you're not materialistic. Why? Because you got lots of material stuff. Take away the material stuff from the Stoics, and I think they would become less emotionally detached. I think you could see a Stoic cry if you took all of his wealth away. But there's a saying in philosophy, and Stoicism is just a philosophy, that most philosophers build a great ivory palace in which they pretend to live. But if you really look, they actually live in a lousy little shack beside it. Because the projection of all the things that they claim that they hold to and all the things that they claim are important, it's just all smoke and mirrors. And if you really dig down and get to the reality, the ivory castle that they've built is never where they live. They always live that humble little hovel beside. That's always been the knock against philosophers. Philosophy, by the way, is a lovely rich man's game. If you don't have to work hard for a living or chase your paycheck, you have all the time in the world to sit and come up with all kinds of strange intellectual ideas and build an ivory castle. The rest of us are all working in our hovels. Anyway, the idea of self-sufficiency. Do you think that's what Paul is talking about here? I suggest no, because Paul uses this word. Remember I said it was used two times in the New Testament? Well, the other usage is in Philippians chapter 4, verses 11 to 13. So have a look over there, please. And in Philippians chapter 4, verse 11, Paul says this, I have learned to be content. Now, do you think Paul is using content in the way that the Stoics would have used it, in the idea of self-sufficiency? By the way, where was Paul when he wrote the letter to the Philippians? In jail. What was Paul praying for every day? Oh Lord, may there be some believers who bring me some food today, because the Roman Empire didn't feed its prisoners. If you didn't get fed by your own friends, and if you didn't provide your own jail cell, you were in trouble. Anyway, Paul says, I have learned to be content. And that, folks, does not mean self-sufficient. In fact, in verse 12, he says, I've learned the secret of being filled and going hungry. Now, we would not assume contentment and going hungry goes together. He says, I've learned the secret of both abundance and suffering need. And then all of a sudden, we get that very famous verse that we probably almost always take out of context. Philippians 4:13, I can do all things through Christ who strengthens me. What is Paul saying? For him, contentment is not self-sufficiency. For him, contentment is total Christ sufficiency. Which is something you learn when you're in jail and they're not feeding you. The context here is not when I see somebody who says, you know, I want to climb Mount Everest, so I'm going to quote, I can do all things through Christ who strengthens me. The context here is that Paul said that he has learned the secret is so fully trusting in Christ that it actually frees one from the materialism and self-sufficiency that deceives most of mankind. By the way, anybody here self-sufficient? I have never fired one brain cell. And there aren't all that many of them left. But I have never fired one brain cell without the help of God. I have never taken one breath without the help of God. I have never had the energy to move one muscle without the help of God. I have no abilities or skills whatsoever and no sense of rationality or reasoning without the help of God. I can't even keep the mass that is me together without the help of God. In other words, can I ever claim to be self-sufficient? Well, then I would be like one of those philosophers, those Stoics, who said, oh, I'm not caught up in the things of this world. Why could they say that? Because they had an abundance of things in this world. Because the good Lord in his mercy and in his kindness allows me to function, I can function. But I can't function in any way, shape, or form without the good Lord allowing me to do it. So if I claim self-sufficiency, what am I? Liar. I have just projected the ivory castle. And I don't even deserve to be living in the hovel. Too many of us think, oh, maybe I'll ask this question, how many of us think? Maybe I'm being too mean here when I say too many of us think. How many of us think, if only we were materially rich, we would be so much more content? Lord's Prayer, what are we asking the Lord for? Give us this day daily bread. What would we really like to ask for? Give us this day a warehouse of bread and a mill to grind flour and a farm to grow wheat and a never-ending supply of wheat so that, Lord, we would never have to bother you again. Just give us everything we need so that we can be self-sufficient. What's the problem with that? How godly would you be if you were that kind of self-sufficient? People shaking their heads here. I wouldn't be godly. Why? Because you would think that you could depend upon self. It doesn't work that way, folks. The manipulation of the false teacher pushes our greed button and actually appeals to our pride button as well. If there's a greed button, there's also a pride button. That I can look after myself. So I'll only pray to God about the big things because I can handle all the little stuff in life. Folks, we can't handle the tiniest little thing of the little stuff in life. We're so desperately dependent upon the mercy and the grace of God to supply us with what we need. But the manipulative false teacher pushes your greed button and he promises you riches, both for you and for him or her. And yet our text this morning tells us that great gain comes from true godliness. And you know what's interesting is what's not there. It's not a true godliness that includes a large portion of materialism. Why does Jesus say we should pray for daily bread? So that at the end of the day, what has been used up? The bread. And when the next day begins, what do? We go back once again to our great and loving God and say to him, please supply me with daily bread. Why? Because that gives us the proper perspective of how much we need God, how desperate we are, and how gracious he is. And it keeps us in this wonderful, intimate, super tight relationship with God, which we really, truly need. True godly gain is not a matter of material wealth, because material wealth does not promote intimate connection with God. Material wealth causes us to drift, and it's a problem. But true godly gain, and this is not an exhaustive list, would contain things like this. Number one, true godly gain drives us to real humility. When we recognize that godliness is the most important, we recognize that we are only godly. Why? Because God in His grace has made dead sinners alive in Christ and is looking after us and is helping us. Wow. What does that mean we are? We are just the humblest of servants looking to the mercy and care of our God. Godly gain produces thankfulness. When you got the warehouse and the bakery and the mill and the farm, are you thankful to God? No. Why? Because you're not even thinking about God. You're thinking about all the stuff you got. Remember Jesus shared that parable about a rich man? He had some good crops. His barns were filled. He started to think, hey, you know what? I got the world by the tail. I'm going to push down these little barns that are full and build bigger barns and fill them and build bigger barns and fill them. And then what am I going to do? I'm going to say, wow, I have enough to live in ease and comfort and luxury for the rest of my days. And then Jesus says, and God had a word for him. And God said, you fool. Tonight your soul will be required of you. You have never been self-sufficient, and you certainly will not stand before me in judgment self-sufficient. Because everything we have, we depend upon the mercy of God for. So we should be thankful. It teaches us Christ dependence, not independence or self-dependence. It teaches us that our security is only found in Christ. It teaches us that there's actually true freedom from the idol of materialism. So here's one of the problems, folks. Materialism is not just an idea or a philosophy to be followed or something that somebody practices. Materialism, trusting in the goods and in the strength of your own hands to produce those goods, is actually an idol. It's something that sets itself up alongside of God and says, bow your knee to materialism. This is not an exhaustive list, but it's enough. Let me make the second point. That was only the first point. I knew that was going to be a long one. Second point, true gain requires the need to scale back or to scale down what we require to live. Well, some are saying here, well, you know, that's, yeah, godliness, great gain, spiritual stuff, yeah, that's good. But I live in a world where I need things. I need lots of things. How many things do we need? Next time you pack to go on a trip, ask yourself, how many bags did you have to pack? What is enough becomes the question. Well, we'd all interject at this point in time that we need some stuff, and that's true. I guess the question we're going to ask ourselves this morning, and it's not an easy question to answer because it probably starts more fights than anything else, is what is an acceptable level of riches for a Christian? Let me give you some considerations. Verse 7, for we have brought nothing into the world, so we cannot take anything out of it either. This is what I call a casket perspective. Now, I'm just using an illustration here. I do not believe that dead people see their funerals. But imagine, if you will, you are dead. They've caught you in the casket. You're being taken from the service to the graveside, and you're inside your casket. And you're thinking, you know what, there's lots of room in here. How come I'm in here all by myself? And why'd they bury me in this suit? And those are the best shoes you could put on me. And wow, there's lots of room in here. You know, you could put more stuff in so that I could take it into the next life. Now, of course, nobody is in the casket wondering what's going on. If you are a believer, to be absent from the body is to be present with the Lord, so you're not watching your own funeral. And if you're a non-believer, you're in a holding cell awaiting judgment, so you're not at your funeral either. Anyway, the point is, what can you take out of this world, even if there's lots of room in your casket? And the answer is, nada. Nothing. In fact, you take less out than you came into this world with, because at least you came into this world with what? A physical body. You developed in your mom for 9 months, And you came into this world with arms and legs and feet and hair and eyes and ears. And what do you leave this world with? You even have to leave what behind? The body. You don't even take that with you. Wow. In other words, when we look at this from a little greater perspective, how important are material things? Well, they are important for the temporary here and now. But the temporary here and now is most certainly not all there is. In fact, in the scope of ratios and proportions, the here and now makes up the tiniest little fraction of your existence. Consideration number two is that material things are a limited time thing. They have limited value, they have limited application, and they're intended to be used right now. Does God give us material things? Sure he does. What's God's intention with giving us material things? Use them. When God gives us things to use, does God expect us to use them in a certain way? Yeah. And part of what the Lord gives to us is designed to be used so that we have the, you know, necessities of living in this world. So that's legit. At what point in time, though, do we go past the expectation and start to use the things that were intended by God to be an investment in his kingdom and to bring glory to himself, and we use them for ourselves? There's your question. Luke chapter 12 talked about the fool who was storing all kinds of stuff away, but he was leaving this world. He wasn't going to be able to use them. Luke chapter 12, verse 31, teaches us to seek God's kingdom. Same chapter. You see, God gives us worldly wealth to be used as his servants for his purposes. The thing that we have to be so careful for with worldly wealth is that it does not steal the place that belongs only to God. That our heart does not become attached to the things of this world, and we start to ignore the God who gave us the things to be used for his purposes. Brought nothing in, can't take anything out. Verse 8, I talked about this whole idea of scaling back. Oh boy, here we go. If we have food and covering, with this we shall be content. Now, some of you looking back at verse 6, you said, hey, Pastor, you said that word contentment there meant self-sufficiency. So I guess in verse 8 it means if we have food and covering with these, this we shall be self-sufficient. No, different word. In this case, content equals what? What you would think of as contentment. Satisfied. Filled. Enough. If we have food and covering, with this we shall say, enough. Our society tells us what? How should we live? What's the word they say? You should live. Okay, I'm using an expression here. Maybe you haven't heard it. Have you ever heard the expression living large? Some of you have heard that expression. What does it mean? It means to use as much as possible. Leave the biggest possible footprint you can. Gather all the stuff you possibly can. And he who dies with the most stuff that he hasn't used wins. Living large. Problem is, as you get into your 50s, you're living large and you're dreaming about living a little slimmer. But anyway, another issue. What this verse tells us is that we need to reject worldly values. Because worldly value says it's all about pleasing self and indulging self and living in luxury. Since there's only one life, the world tells us, which is absolutely false. Live it as big as you can right now. That is completely counter-gospel. What's interesting here is that word have in 8 is actually a participle, and it's identifying a particular group. Again, our English isn't bringing this out, but let me bring this out for you. Let me unpack this, as they say. If we have, here we're talking about a group that can be readily identified by this particular behavior. We should be part of the group that is identified by what? By the ones who are satisfied with the basic necessities of life. Now, we can get into a debate, what are the basic necessities of life? The sense here is that food and covering would be shelter, covering would be clothing. If we have enough to eat and we have basic security, if we have the basic essentials of life, you know what? We should be part of the group that is identified by that. We are supposed to be part of the group that is not seeking to live your best life now. Let me throw a book title in here. Because unfortunately, this is another form of false teaching. God does not say, live your best life now. God says, serve me now. I realize you need certain things for living. I will supply those things. But don't err on the side of indulgence and luxury. Err on the side of simplicity and serve me now. Everything else is a way for certain individuals to make themselves rich by selling books that people go, that pushed my greed button and my self button. I like that book. You see, the reality is that less should be easier for us to control. And what's the problem with wealth? Well, we think that wealth will be a good servant to us because we will control it. What is the problem? Wealth, much like debt, is not a good servant that we easily control. Wealth, much like debt, becomes a lousy master that controls us. And so our wealth begins to own us. And now we find ourselves in a predicament. Because we are called to be the slaves of Christ, and wealth calls us to be a slave of wealth. And how much of our time do we spend satisfying the demands of wealth? Because heaven forbid that our wealth should start to decrease. And we have bought so many things, and we have so many payments, and we have to work 12 hours a day and 6 days a week. Why? So that we can keep our wealth going. And why are we doing that? In most cases, because we're trying to project an image. And why are we trying to project an image? Because we're pushing our own pride button. As a slave of Christ, do we serve our wealth, or does our wealth serve the purposes of God? You see, true gain must be godly gain, and godly gain reflects God's values. And you know what? It's probably always a matter of scaling down. But true gain is a matter of using resources, not hoarding resources, or even worse, wallowing in resources. And if you're feeling convicted, that's good, because I'm feeling convicted here. You know what? I know I can live with less. And what scares me someday is, should I die and be like the rich man, and my barns are full, and I've been called to be a servant of Christ, I haven't used it for his glory and for his purposes. As a servant of God, he has given me material resources to be invested and used for his glory and for the building of his kingdom. And if I have hoarded those things or wallowed in those things and not used them properly, I face a judgment. And so I'm not trying to pick on you, because I'm picking on myself here this morning. The third point, the danger of the desire for riches. You know, what's interesting is that this particular passage is not written to rich people. That comes in verse 17 of this chapter. This particular passage is written to those who want to be rich. So you might say this morning, well, I'm not really rich, so this doesn't apply to me. Do you want to be rich? Is that one of the longings of your heart? Then it's written for you and me. But those who want to get rich, that's hunger after being rich, that's dream of getting rich, that's long for being rich. Why? Because riches would solve all my problems. The longing to be rich. Another identifying principle. It's actually a group identified here. Those who want to get rich. This is just kind of the... all my issues would be resolved if only I was rich. What happens to this group of people? Well, three things. Number one, they fall. Later on, we're going to say they plunge into problems. If the desire of your heart is to be rich and you think that that's the answer to your problems, you will fall into temptation and into a snare. Because riches are actually easily become an idolatry, an idol, and wealth becomes your consuming focus instead of the Lord being your consuming focus. And what this does is it leads to exposure to unwholesome suggestions and to unscrupulous opportunities. Have you ever found those who get rich are able to justify all kinds of things that aren't right? It's kind of scary, isn't it? So you're going to fall into temptation and a snare. The second thing that's going to happen is that there's going to be many foolish and harmful desires. The word there is craving to be rich. It's a profound longing for this. It captures the very heart of the person. By the way, which church is this written to? I mean, it's written to Timothy, but which church is he serving? Ephesian church? What does John write to the Ephesian church in Revelation? Where's their first love? It's not Christ. He's talking to people who seem to have a problem with loving money. Third thing is it plunges a man into ruin and destruction. The promise of wealth is a false promise, because the promise of wealth is that it will deliver you from ruin and destruction, and it almost always has the exact opposite effect. Then you get to verse 10, and what's interesting here is that verse 10 basically repeats the three ideas and builds on them a little bit. So it says, those who want to be rich, they fall into temptation and a snare. What does verse 10 says? For the love of money is the root of all sorts of evil. All right? Not only is a temptation and a snare the desire to be rich, but kind of like sexual sin, which is rather similar to the desire to be rich, it pulls you into evil. Kind of like a blackberry plant, it just kind of spreads all over the place. And what is it? It's the love of money is the root. And by the way, root is the emphasized word here in verse 10. It's hard to control, like a blackberry, or even worse, what is those white flowers, bindweed, I think is what we call it. Morning glories, whatever they are, they grow up all over and choke everything out. Try and kill those things sometimes. Their roots just go all over the place. Or horsetail, like I've got in my backyard. Or that lovely little silver green plant that comes in planters that I planted one time and has taken over half my yard. Or moss. They all have terrible roots. Anyway, my love of gardening is just going away. You see, the problem is that if you love money, not talking about here about, you know, appreciating money and using it wisely, but if you love money, if the desire of your heart is more and more and more and more and more, if you're Scrooge McDuck, then you have a problem. Why? Because it's the root of all sorts of evil. What did it say? They fall into temptation and a snare. That temptation and snare is taking you into evil. Secondly, it says some by longing for it. There's that craving. Oh, my dreams are constantly, will I win the lottery? Will I inherit? How can I get rich? By longing for it, some have wandered away from the faith. Oh, boy. You see, it produces, what was the second part in verse 9? It produces many foolish and harmful desires. Foolish and harmful desires are wandering away from the faith. And it plunges men into ruin and destruction. And it says they've wandered from the faith, and what have they done? They have pierced themselves with many griefs. You know, the love of money will most certainly lead you to ruin and destruction. Just the context of this particular letter, back in chapter 1, verses 19 to 20. Paul was warning Timothy. What did he say? He said, fight the good fight. And then he kind of warned him and he said, beware. Remember two individuals in the church. One was named Hymenaeus. One was named Alexander. Poor Hymie and Alex. What happened to them? They had their faith what? Shipwrecked. Now, does that mean that their faith was gone? No. Because the way that the next verse reads, that they're looking for restoration for these guys. But what has happened to their faith? It has suffered tremendous damage. Their faith has been shipwrecked, and they have been handed over to Satan. And you're going, whoa, that's intense, that's scary. Well, by the way, if you're not serving God, who are you serving? You think you're serving self, but that's a lie. You end up serving the powers of evil. You end up serving the devil. And all of a sudden, their faith has been shipwrecked. They've been handed over to Satan. Why? So that they might be taught not to blaspheme. The purpose of this is actually so they can be restored down the road. But there's going to be a whole lot of pain before the restoration happens, isn't there? Those who love money don't necessarily lose their salvation, because we didn't gain our salvation by our own efforts. We don't lose it by our own efforts. But what we can do is we can take the blessed life that should be ours in Jesus Christ, and we can give ourselves a piercing with all kinds of grief by doing foolish things. You're going to pay the price if you love money. Why? Because Jesus said it straight up. You can't love both God and money. You either love one and hate the other, or you love the other and hate the one. You cannot serve both God and money. And yet we have a generation of Christians who is desperately trying to do exactly that. Can't be done. The longing for riches makes us susceptible to foolish and harmful desires that lead to much pain, ruin, and destruction. Therefore, avoid the danger of an unhealthy, obsessive love for riches. Are material things evil? No. But when you love material things and it draws away your love for God and it occupies your mind and it starts to control you, then unfortunately the love of those material things indeed is evil. Fourth point. We need to learn to keep a safe distance from materialism. And we need to do that by focusing on true godliness. What's the word in verse 11? Flee! How much distance is there in a flee? Oh, more than a couple steps. There's considerable distance in a flee, isn't there? Even if you flee slowly, you should get some distance. What's interesting here is, but you, O man of God. That's how the verse begins. That's the emphatic part here. If you are a man of God, and what makes you a man of God or a woman of God? God has called you. God has redeemed you. God has made you alive. But you, O man of God, flee from these things. Now, is distance simply enough to protect you from the love of riches and the pull of materialism? No, you know, you're not going to be able to put enough distance there. But it's a starting point. Get yourself separated from it, and then do what? How hard do people who love money pursue money? Pretty hard. It's pretty obsessive. It's pretty compulsive. It's pretty indulging. The word here, and pursue. There's a good word. Go after this with zeal and with commitment and with focus and with intensity. What are we going after? There's three little couplets here. Righteousness and godliness. Let's start with godliness. What is godliness? It's the way you relate to God. It's the relationship you have with God. What difference does godliness make? Well, it should produce in you practical righteousness. Now, we have positional righteousness in Christ, but there should be practical righteousness. And in this case, the righteousness is the way that we deal with the human beings around us. So because we have this special vertical relationship with God that God has established, and we are godly, in other words, we are in a close, vital, growing, life-giving relationship with God. What does this do? This then affects the way that we relate to one another, and we relate to one another with righteousness. By the way, those who love money, do they relate to their fellow man in righteousness? Probably not. Probably not. The next two words are faith and love. Pursue faith. What is faith? Faith is that daily, complete, trusting in the mercy and provision of God. Every single day you say, "Oh Lord, it's only you. I lay myself before you. Supply what I need. Change what needs to be changed. Lead me in the way that I need to be led. It's all about you." There's the vertical. What happens to the horizontal? All of a sudden we have love that probably affects the others around us. Do people who love money love others? Not so much. And then the last two are perseverance and gentleness. Perseverance is going to the Lord every day and saying, "Lord, you have told us that we are to pursue your strength." Colossians tells us that we're supposed to look for that strength that comes from the might of God, according to the might of God. "Lord, give me strength." Why? "Because I am tempted to do what I shouldn't do. Give me strength to be fair to you, and give me strength to live in a world that doesn't seem to understand what I'm all about, because I'm all about you." And then the last word there is gentleness, and that's interesting. That is a unique word in the New Testament, only found here. And I'm not sure that gentleness is necessarily the best translation. Probably a better translation here is humility. We need to pursue humility, because when we no longer have that exposed pride button, that kind of protects the greed button, which kind of doesn't allow the false teachers to push either button, which refocuses us rather completely. "Lord, what am I? I am not my own man, I am not my own woman, and this life is not all about me, whether I'm over the age of 50 or not." By the way, the evil 50s tell you once again it's all about you, and it's not. "Lord, I am your redeemed servant. I was an object of wrath. You, in your love and in your grace and in your mercy, you bought me with the blood of your own son. I belong to you body and soul. I am yours. I am no longer mine. I am yours." The proper relationship with God, some true humility. Materialism has a hard time dealing with true humility, because materialism says it's all about you. Present yourself, promote yourself, project yourself. And humility says, "I'm only God's redeemed slave for his purposes." Godliness brings true gain. Folks, we need to understand, number one, that godliness is not essentially a financial thing. There's just no promise of earthly wealth in the gospel. That's false teaching. Secondly, godliness brings true gain. How? By actually teaching us the need to scale down our own expenses so that the kingdom resources that God has entrusted to us are not squandered on our own luxuries, or even worse, on our own faithless hoarding. Why do people hoard so much? Because they don't want to trust in God. They want to trust in what they got in the bank or in wherever. Godliness brings true gain. How? By teaching us that a longing for riches brings nothing but evil and destruction. So we need to stop this now. And godliness brings true gain. How? By allowing us to become separate from materialism and replace that all-consuming pursuit of things with the pursuit of what is actually godly. And my prayer this morning is that we would be able to do these things, that the Lord would change us in our heart of hearts and at our very core, so that we would not be idolaters chasing after things and after the luxury of things, but rather that we would be God's people, and that we would know that godliness alone is great gain.